500,000 refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
The roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bowtie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals, and in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as France-Afrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers, but French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Kashmir is decorated with Indian flags as India is marking its 75th Independence Day anniversary. Government offices, schools, colleges, official vehicles, roads and streets in and around Kashmir were decorated with the Indian flag as part of a government-led nationwide campaign dubbed Tricolor in Every Home. In Srinagar's Sheri Kashmir Stadium, Kashmir's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the Indian tricolor in the presence of government officials.
A new dawn of hopes and dreams is here. Since August 2019, the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir is scripting history and is recording unprecedented performance in every sector.
The administration in Kashmir took stringent security measures to ensure a smooth flag hoisting ceremony. Barbed wires were stretched across roads, guarded by security forces to avoid the breach of security or any militant attack. Shops and business establishments were closed and traffic remained largely suspended. But prominent politicians in Kashmir say holding such celebrations in Kashmir only hurts the sentiments of the people of Kashmir and is just rubbing salt in the wounds after what they call India's illegal move of scrapping Kashmir's special status on August 5, 2019.
Post-abrogation of Article 370, New Delhi has not been fair to the people of Kashmir. It was a death of democracy. People's wishes and aspirations were not considered. The unfurling of the tricolor in the city center by a handful of people amid tough security is not what we call normality. If it was normal, people would have participated in large numbers, and this is what the government of India needs to address.
He added, in the absence of political process, people of Kashmir seem to have lost all rights and have been silenced. The decisions are taken without taking people on board.
On August 5, 2019, New Delhi abrogated Kashmir's special status and divided the region into two parts, calling it integrating the region with the rest of India. Experts say if India wants to win over the hearts of Kashmiri people, instead of imposing decisions, India must start addressing the concerns of people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Meet Rira, the latest crossover car produced by Iran's giant automaker, Iran Khodro. The vehicle was unveiled at Iran Khodro's factory west of Tehran. The Iranian automaker says this is the first crossover ever built in Iran, which can compete with international rivals. Iranian automakers, namely Iran Khodro and Saipa, have picked up the slack after Francis Peugeot and Renault, along with other international automotive companies, exited Iran in 2018 in the wake of U.S. sanctions on Tehran that created a supply crunch, pushing car prices to unprecedented highs. The crisis forced Iranian companies to produce Iranian-made vehicles. While admitting the adverse effects of U.S. sanctions, Iran Khodro Managing Director Mehdi Khatibi said the measures have had their silver lining.
We don't agree with sanctions. We favor free international trade. However, sanctions helped us become an automaker, and today I should tell you that Iran Khodro is a respectable and reliable car producer in the world.
Iranian-made cars already roll on the streets of countries such as Iraq, Syria, Azerbaijan, and Senegal. However, Iran Khodro has higher ambitions, planning to export 100,000 cars each year.
In Turkmenistan, we have exported our buses. Our new market will be North Africa, especially Tunisia, where we have already presented our Rona model. We will also resume exporting to Venezuela and Armenia. And all this have come despite U.S. sanctions.
Launched in 1966, Iran Khodro Industrial Group, or shortly IKCO, started by producing the first Iranian-made car, Paycon, based on Britain's Hillman Hunter in the 1960s. Paycon was discontinued in 2005. Some of the old-fashioned cars, such as Peugeot 206, are still rolling off the production lines of Iran Khodro. However, the Iranian car maker says it will soon stop producing them. It plans to focus on manufacturing luxury cars such as Rira, which it regards as a bridge toward a foothold in the global market.
With all the ups and downs, Iran Khodro has come a long way from copying foreign designs to manufacturing its own cars. However, the Iranian automaker says it's not complacent with where it stands and will continue its journey toward making cars on par with international brands. Yusuf Jalalip, Tehran.
Austria is famous for its stunning architecture and artistic legacy, boasting to be the home of the great German composers, including Mozart and Beethoven. Sadly, however, Austria has built up another reputation in recent years, that of growing intolerance towards its Muslim minority. According to data released in June 2022, over 1,000 Islamophobic incidents were reported the previous year, a shocking increase which has grown year upon year.
Research into anti-Muslim hate crimes in Austria have found that the overwhelming majority of the incidents which take place has been men targeting women, with a staggering 69% of victims being female, many of whom wear the hijab. However, it's not just on the street level where the targeted harassment of Muslims is taking place.
The sharp spike of 2021 was allegedly assisted by the controversial state-implemented Islam map, introduced by authorities to highlight the location of all mosques across Austria. Critics believe it aided in the spread of hate crimes. Press TV sat down with Iman Shaker, who's experienced firsthand what it's like to be a target of hate after she was almost physically assaulted for wearing a hijab.
I don't think you can name a single visibly Muslim person in this country that hasn't been verbally attacked or even physically. And I try to not give a lot of attention to the individual attacks I face, because that would just be, that would just be very...
Although it was hard to relive the experience, Iman doesn't believe in playing the victim, instead focusing on the root cause.
Focusing on a single perpetrator and focusing my anger towards him would be very weakening, in my opinion, because in the end he has fallen victim to the narrative that the state has given him about us being a threat.
In November 2020, Austrian authorities launched Operation Luxor, which saw homes and offices of Muslim charities and activists raided as part of a so-called war on political Islam. But critics claim its only achievement is dehumanizing Muslims and fueling growing public fear towards Islam. An increase in fear almost certainly leads to more hate. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence, which refers to the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons in the defense of South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists marched through central Vienna on Friday to vent their anger following Israel's recent bombardment of Gaza. They joined thousands of other protesters worldwide who were shocked into action after the three-day Israeli offensive left over 350 Palestinians wounded, 46 dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials.
Following the recent violence against Gaza, shocking images of children suffering and dying went absolutely viral on social media. Yet despite these disturbing images doing the rounds, they haven't been routinely featured in Western mainstream media circles. In fact, it's incredibly rare for any images of Palestinian suffering to be published at all.
They are suffering every day, every single day. People got arrested, children got arrested, people got murdered. Gaza, what we saw last week in three, 4 days, got bombed. They have no electricity, they have no way to go anywhere. They are blocked from the Israeli occupation.
I need to tell my people that we are standing up for them. We are resisting from abroad. So you have to stay strong. And I'm an artist, so it is a duty for me to raise the voice for the ones who are not heard.
We need to raise our voice, and Austria cooperates with Israel. And that's what we are doing here also is that we want to make people aware of this, that Austria is cooperating with Israel.
Despite regular condemnation of Israeli aggression by human rights groups, Palestinians continue to suffer while the Western world looks on, leaving few options left for Palestinians driven to fight for their very survival. Robert Carter, Vienna. As Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza and Al-Quds persist, another war continues to rage on in Europe. The battle pits pro-Palestine activists pushing a global anti-Israel boycott campaign versus local authorities who back ties with Israel. Founded in 2005, Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a Palestinian-led movement promoting economic sanctions on Israel. Due to the movement's popularity, Tel Aviv has lobbied European lawmakers to criminalize the group and its activities. France, Germany and Britain are key battlegrounds, but lesser known is the struggles of the BDS in Austria. Speaking to local members, a crackdown on BDS activism remains ongoing.
It started in 2018 when, for example, the local city government of Vienna, they implemented city resolutions, for example, against the BDS movement, where they say all local institutions and governmental institutions are not allowed anymore to support the movement, so which means all public places, they are restricted for us. And all these restrictions against the BDS movement in Austria, in Europe, and worldwide, I think it's a reaction from the Zionist movement and from the Zionist lobby, because BDS is getting stronger and stronger.
The Vienna city government are currently suing a BDS Austria representative over a Facebook post showing an image plastered over an official city poster. Elsewhere, support for the BDS can get you labelled anti-Semitic due to Austria adopting the controversial IHRA definition on anti-Semitism.
European authorities are introducing new legislation which aims to stop the activities of the peaceful boycott campaign. But policing people's desires not to invest in the Israeli regime is proving a near impossible task. Speaking to representatives of the BDS here in Vienna, they say that the response is an inevitable backlash to the group's success in undermining and damaging Israel's reputation across the continent. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. We now present you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled England Failing to Invest in Water Networks to Avoid Future Droughts. The UK's infrastructure chief has warned England is failing to invest in the water networks needed to avoid a future of recurrent serious droughts, with current policies amounting to the government keeping its fingers crossed. Sir John Armitt, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, said, with more hot, dry spells interspersed with heavier rainfall, the current drought was a warning that water systems could not cope with the changing climate. He warned, investment is better than keeping your fingers crossed and relying on emergency measures. He said ministers could not prevent dry weather, but they could direct investment into infrastructure to cope with it, such as reservoirs and cutting wastage. Sir John Armitt added, the government should set out what degree of risk from drought they would see as reasonable for people to manage and expect. He warned water bills may have to increase to pay for the investment needed. Sir John Armitt told The Guardian in an interview, if you want greater resilience to drought, then you have to increase water bills or general taxation to pay for it. Drought was declared in 8 of England's 14 regions recently after a meeting of the National Drought Group, made up of ministers, civil servants, water companies and conservation groups. 5 water areas have so far put in place hosepipe bans, though farmers have called for more, as ministers were briefed that farmers face the ruin of up to half their crops. In several areas in the drought-stricken south of England, people have been forced to queue in the street as their water systems failed. In the village of North End in Oxfordshire, people have been relying on tankers. In and around Guildford in Surrey, handouts of bottled water began at the weekend after a pump failure at Netley Mill Treatment Works. In Everton in Bedfordshire, an already unreliable supply has been further threatened by drought. Hydrologists have claimed these are isolated incidents and that measures such as standpipes, a vivid memory for some from the last most serious drought in 1976, were highly unlikely to be needed in the current drought, as water companies were more resilient and better prepared than they were nearly half a century ago. The National Infrastructure Commission has estimated the cost of overhauling the UK's water networks at £20 billion by 2050, considerably less than the £27 billion the government has earmarked for new roads this Parliament, which campaigners say are not needed. Sir John Armitt said this cost was dwarfed by the cost of drought. He warned, in increasingly frequent droughts, you'll probably have to spend twice that much on bottled water from the back of lorries. He said new reservoirs should be strongly considered, despite the difficulty of obtaining planning permission, particularly in the southeast of England. In an interview with The Guardian, he noted water metering was also likely to be needed to encourage people to cut their usage of water. But the government is not keen. Sir John Armitt, chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, called for a national debate on how to fund water improvements. The two Tory leadership candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak, have called for action but shied away from setting out clear proposals on investment. Sir John Armitt asked, "You have to balance water investment. Do you put it back through people's bills or through general taxation?" adding, "You have to ensure poor people are not being penalised." He said the role of water companies should be scrutinised. He noted, "There has been criticism of water companies paying dividends to investors. That has to be an issue for governments and regulators to decide." He added, "You can argue that water companies have invested too little. Going forward, the real challenge is for government to say what level of performance the public should be entitled to expect." People could have a substantial impact on water usage by changing their behaviour, for instance by not leaving taps running and running washing machines only on full loads. But Sir John Armitt warned this would not be enough alone, and the government under a new Prime Minister would face uncomfortable choices over the investment needed for new reservoirs and new infrastructure. He said, "There is a cost of living crisis, especially with energy bills, and people don't want to hear about water bills going up too." He added, "But one way or another, we have to find a way to pay for this new infrastructure." Sir John Armitt added, "Poorer households could be protected if the government stepped in to make the current billing systems fairer." England has experienced its driest July since 1911, with only about 10% of the average rainfall for the time of year in the south of England. The period since November has been the driest 8-month period in England since 1976. After a dry spell for almost 50 years, the United Kingdom is now being warned to expect flooding from thundery showers that will offer little relief from the drought. The flood alert follows days of extreme heat warnings and the official declaration of a drought after the longest 9-month dry spell since 1976. Meteorologists warned that Downpours are the wrong kind of rain to tackle the drought and are more likely to lead to flash floods from water running off parched earth. The heat wave is forecast to break with a yellow warning for thunderstorms covering almost all of the United Kingdom, all of England and Wales, and most of southern and eastern England in the coming days. The Meteorological Office warned of torrential downpours and possible disruption in some spots, adding that homes and businesses could be flooded quickly and buildings damaged by floodwater. It also said power cuts were possible. The Environment Agency also warned that properties could flood and travel could be disrupted by surface water. John Curtin, the agency's Executive Director of Operations, tweeted that the United Kingdom was in that twilight zone of having both flood and drought warnings. He said heavy thundery rain on parched and hard ground would lead to rapid runoff and heightened flood risk in the coming days. But this will in no way correct weeks of dry weather, so most of England will remain in drought. Professor Hannah Cloak, an expert in hydrology at the University of Reading, said the forecast rain was unlikely to be long-lasting or widespread enough to make a big difference to some exceptionally low levels in reservoirs and rivers. Dan Stroud, a forecaster at the Meteorological Office, said, "We're coming to the end of an extended very hot spell, and the ground has been baked, so it's extremely dry. The weather is breaking down into a mixture of heavy and thundery showers." Dan Stroud added, "And rain from really intense downpours will be unable to soak into the baked ground quickly. It's very difficult for the water to actually get in because it has to force the air out of the soil. So dry ground gets very quickly overwhelmed and we then get surface runoff." He added, "What we really need is a continuous period of light rain or drizzle just to gently re-wet the soil. Intense downpours are not exceptionally helpful. It's going to take a lot of rain over an extended period of time to actually recharge the aquifers and reservoirs." Dan Stroud added, "Almost anywhere was at risk of the impact of thundery downpours, but it was difficult to pinpoint exactly where." He said, "Scotland and Northern Ireland were most at risk. The risk develops initially across Wales and the southwest of England, and then more widely across England during the coming days." Rob Thompson, who conducted the demonstration, said, "Dry, parched ground doesn't let water in as effectively as already moist ground because the soil is resisting water entering. The water sits on the surface to run off down slopes or simply sit in a pool." Three water companies, Welsh Water, Southern Water and South East Water, have imposed hosepipe bans, while Yorkshire Water has announced that a ban will start on 26th of August, and Thames Water is planning one in the coming weeks.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Headlines could not be more alarming. Trump raid led to civil war calls.
dirty bomb attack on FBI headquarters. The far right is calling for civil war after the FBI raid on Trump's home. Experts say that fight wouldn't look like the last one. Why are Trump supporters calling for a civil war? Was the FBI raid unconstitutional? And was it a way to eliminate Trump or prevent him from running in the 2024 elections? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the former U.S. president has played such a divisive role in the U.S. and its population, and whether the U.S. is really headed towards some kind of civil war. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Gerald Horn joins us. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston, who joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us, Robert Petillo, a political strategist, who joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Gerald Horn, I'm going to start with you and ask you about this raid by the FBI on Trump's Florida home. It was about classified documents. It turned out to be that some of those classified or portion of it were nuclear related. And then it was an all-out raid from what we understand. Passports of Trump was confiscated. Did you think that that search warrant by the FBI was something that was okay in the way it was carried out?
Well, it's hard to say because the underlying affidavit has yet to be released. But according to news reports, Mr. Trump had the nuclear documents. He had a dossier on French President Mr. Macron. And it's suspected that given Mr. Trump's money-making abilities, that he was going to try, apparently, to sell these nuclear documents to a foreign power and perhaps to blackmail Mr. Macron. Now, of course, that is speculation, to put it mildly. But on the surface, as of now, it appears that this search was by the book. Certainly, it was unprecedented. But then again, Mr. Trump has been an unprecedented president. That is to say, the kinds of transgressions and misdeeds that he has routinely been involved in certainly surpasses what any other U.S. president has been involved in.
One of the things that has been a topic of conversation, Robert Petillo, is the fact that many are saying that this was a way for preventing Trump from running in the presidential elections. Do you believe that this was an attempt by either the current administration, the FBI, or combined for that result?
No, I do not, because President Trump lost by 7 million votes in the year 2020. Even when he won the presidency in 2016, he lost the popular vote by, I think, 5 million votes then. If, quite frankly, the best thing for President Biden and for the Democratic Party is to continue to have President Trump at the center for American politics, because for every voter that he animates and aspires to vote, two to three more are aspired to vote against him. So I think this is part of Trump's arrogance, Trump's hubris, to think that he can commit crimes and then just simply blame it on political expediency, as opposed to the several crimes that have been enumerated that he did commit. If you look at the U.S. Espionage Act passed in 1917, I think it's 18 U.S.C. 793 subsection F, merely having documents related to national security in your possession, whether classified or not, constitutes a serious felony in the United States of America. There is no doubt that President Trump did exactly that. And the FBI was well within their rights and well within their responsibilities to execute this search warrant in this nature, because they had asked him for over a year to return the documents peacefully. President Trump is yet to articulate why he didn't just turn those documents over if he did not want to be raided.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got those two questions out of the way. Now we're going to go to the more disturbing aspects of this, Gerald Horn. And this is where America is at. The FBI warning that its Mar-a-Lago raid has sparked disturbing calls for all-out civil war. I'm just reading some of the headlines. Threats including targeted killings of all involved, and a radioactive dirty bomb at the Bureau's headquarters was something that was unveiled. And you have things like a man armed with an AR-15 died in a shootout after trying to breach FBI offices in Cincinnati. And there's some other incidents also. Gerald Horn, how did it get to this? I mean, I wasn't really sure as to how many supporters of Trump actually are ones that are violent in nature to this degree. Does that surprise you, or were you aware that these are the types of supporters Trump has?
It does not surprise me at all. Keep in mind that the United States, there are more guns floating around than there are people. Keep in mind that manufacturing of weapons is a major industry in this country, many of them exported to neighbors such as Mexico. Keep in mind as well that there are many freelance so-called militias in this country that are armed to the teeth. Look at what happened on January 6, 2021, when many of these militias, including the Three Percenters, the Proud Boys, and others, were involved in an apparent coup d'etat, attempted coup d'etat against the United States government. I think that you should also remember that as we speak, unfolding in the state of Michigan is a criminal trial involving certain militiamen who supposedly were going to try to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, and possibly execute her. So this is a very violent culture. It's a culture that was based upon violent dispossession of the Native American population, mass enslavement of the African population. There was a civil war in this country between 1861 to 1865. Many of the underlying issues that led to that civil war have not been resolved to this very day. And I think that if there is a civil war, which I don't think will happen in the short term, but if it happens before the century ends, I think that one of the triggers, possibly, will be the Obama presidency. It's not as if Barack Obama ruled in a radical direction or in a radical fashion. In fact, his policies, as Iranians can surely attest, were certainly within the mainstream of U.S. foreign policy and indeed domestic policy. But I think that the very fact that you had a president of African descent in a country like this, where people of African descent have been treated so shabbily and horribly, it triggered something very deep and profound within the Trump base, which has now led us to what might be the brink of civil war.
That's exactly what I want to find out here, Robert Petillo. What our guest there said is exactly the point here. You could have supporters, you can have mad people feeling angry, but there's a fine line between that anger translating into, I'm going to kill the FBI, and then acting on that. I think, you know, these are just transgressions that doesn't seem normal. Because, as you said, Trump lost. They don't believe that. And that is one of the things that's at the heart of this. But for them to, or for the Trump supporters, or the ones who have advocated violence in the form and manner that the FBI thinks that these are prelude to, well, maybe civil war, maybe extreme, but what happened with the insurrection? They're saying all the signs are there for that, something similar like that to happen. Do you agree with that?
I can definitely agree with that. I think we are in for perhaps a decade of guerrilla activities from these quote-unquote Trump supporters. Remember, Trump is a symptom. He is not the sickness. The underlying sickness of this is white supremacy within this country. America is a country that historically has been, as we recently, in the 1960s, a 90% white nation. As predicted that by 2040, we'll be a majority-minority nation. In response to this, we've seen increasing extremism coming from the radical far-right wing, whether it be in Charlottesville, whether it be the Oklahoma City bombing or Ruby Ridge, on down the line. And President Trump has taken these groups and fomented them and turned them into a political movement. These people feel that they have a leader in Trump, that they have someone who feels their pain. This is why they have these rallies for Trump in the middle of nowhere on a Wednesday night. They'll draw 10 or 20,000 people out there. So this is a very distinct minority group in this country, but they are very passionate. They are well armed. As was mentioned, almost every household in America has multiple firearms. So I don't think we're headed towards civil war. But if we count it as an insurgency, people who commit acts of domestic terrorism, mass shootings, bombings of federal buildings, the execution of federal agents, I think that will be part of just the way of American life in the next decade. And just as school shootings and other mass shootings have become part of our normal everyday life that we pay little attention to, I think something very similar will happen with these white nationalist extremist groups between now and when they become a minority group, as they have to adapt to the new normal as no longer being the dominant ethnic group in America.
Gerald Horn, do you think that things have gotten to the point where the temperature has gotten so high and has been consecutively throughout the years remained at that point, either within the minority of Americans who have violence maybe in them, but the temperature remains so high that there needs to be an outlet for it? And that outlet, it seems to have surpassed talks, that it has to be violent in nature. Has America reached that point?
Well, I'm afraid so. And ordinarily, I would endorse the idea of talks. But keep in mind that it's difficult to talk with people who are irrational. As has already been noted, many in the Trump base do not feel that he lost the election in 2020. That is what is driving many of them, and that is what is animating many of them. And in fact, I would also say that one of the reasons that so many people are surprised by this turn of events in this country is that my particular guilt, speaking of historians, have not done a very good job in writing the history of this country. If you wrote an accurate and true account of this country, you would find that this country was violent from the arrival of the first European settlers centuries ago. That's how they wound up with the land, and Native Americans wound up dead and buried. And we saw further evidence of these disturbing and troubling trends just in the last 24 hours, when the daughter of the former U.S. Vice President, Dick Cheney, lost her congressional seat by about 30 points in the state of Wyoming, one of the most conservative states in the United States of America. She voted with Mr. Trump while in office at the rate of about 90%. At the same time, she turned against Mr. Trump after the attempted coup, and therefore her base turned against her. That's one of the disturbing aspects of what's happening in the United States of America as we speak. As noted, Mr. Trump is just a symptom. He is not leading this base around by the nose. The base has a mind of its own, and they see Mr. Trump as their vehicle to accomplish some of their short-term gains.
Interesting. Somewhat of what you just said there, Robert Petillo, was echoed by Gerald Horn. Now, if we then try to use role models to calm things down in this situation, particularly what happened after the raid, that seems to be also a far cry here. I'm looking at some of these senators, Republican, Rep. Paul Gosar of Arizona, equating the investigation with tyranny and tweeting, "We must destroy the FBI." Or you have another one by the name of Green, Marjorie Taylor Greene, calling for defunding the FBI. So even lawmakers, of course, I'm citing Republican lawmakers who have made these statements. So that adds more fuel to the fire of people who want to do something about the raid and, of course, the fallout from it.
Well, this was part of what happened in Trump's second impeachment after the attack on the Capitol, that it was stated during that period of time that if he was not convicted by the Senate and barred from running, that this would metastasize into exactly what it's metastasizing into right now. And you can use historical precedents. What happens when there is an attempted coup that fails, but you do not find some way to mollify or to take away that unifying leader? You can look at Hitler and the Beer Hall Putsch in 1933. They came back years, 5 years later and took over the whole country. If you look at Napoleon, the coup d'etat de 18 Brumaire, Chateau de Saint-Cloud in 1799, or they attempted to take over the entire government. That led to 2 decades of the Napoleonic Wars. So what has to happen at this point in time is President Trump be prosecuted for the crimes he has committed, and indeed be jailed along with many of the other leaders of the coup, the leaders of the insurrection, because if you fail to do so, you allow these individuals to continue to consolidate power, and that's how you do get on a footing for civil war. You have to nip these things in the bud. It should have been nipped in the bud 3 years ago, but at this point in time, the number of crimes are piling up, and the American system doesn't appear to have the ability to adequately deal with these unless you have the political courage of a Justice Department willing to try this individual and judicial system willing to jail this these individuals to prevent them from actually raising an army and potentially overthrowing the government. Many of these people have been calling for what's called a constitutional convention, a meeting of the states, to redraw the entirety of the American Constitution to enshrine white supremacy directly into a new constitution. That's what these people want, and we cannot allow them to do so.
Okay, my last question was what you just addressed, so I'm going to ask my last question to Gerald Horn. This is what one of the headlines read, and it said we shouldn't be afraid to prosecute Trump, that strong democracies can actually hold political leaders accountable for breaking the law. Is the U.S. strong enough at this point as a democracy to go ahead and prosecute Trump?
I would like to say yes, but actually, to be honest, I'm not really sure, because these folks in this country are so well armed, they're so well organized, and some of them have nothing to lose. And then I think that they've taken a lesson from U.S. foreign policy. That is to say, the United States, with regard to dealing with foreign countries, oftentimes has acted as if power comes out of the barrel of a gun. If you have a problem with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, you invade Iraq and overthrow the government. You engage in covert action for decades in Afghanistan, for example, oftentimes overt and kinetic action. You invade Panama and overthrow the government. You invade Grenada and overthrow the government. And so once you execute such harebrained policies abroad, inevitably the message is communicated to those at home that they should do the same thing. It's a case of chickens coming home to roost, I'm afraid to say.
So if that's the case, Robert Petillo, I know you made some suggestions, but at this point, there's got to be some kind of solution. Like-minded people should get together on this issue regarding not just Trump, but to save America. If it's going down this road where somewhere, at some point, something's going to burst, this raid, the insurrection, and I'm sorry to say, but if there are going to be another elections coming up in a couple of years, that could be a perfect venue for something to happen. So what should be done?
Oh, you look at the history as our guide. If you look at what happened in the 1850s and the decade leading up to the U.S. Civil War, there were chances for political discussion, for bold leadership. Instead, what they did was kick the can down the road on the issue of slavery, continuing to admit more slave and more free states, having fugitive slave laws that increasingly made it more difficult for African Americans to pursue their freedom. We cannot do the same thing which we are doing currently on this method of appeasement. This is why it's so important to have an empowered judiciary and an empowered Department of Justice in order to prosecute these people. The reason they're saying defund the FBI is because many of those people understand that they will be the next ones under investigation by the FBI. If we allow the rule of law to govern as it's supposed to in this country, then these individuals can be arrested, indicted, tried, convicted, and jailed. And that's how you put out that ember of revolution that they're trying to foment.
Gerald Horn, what are your views on Trump in the way that he not only reacted after the insurrection, before the insurrection, but also now that this has happened? He seems to be touching us on some hot-button issues to get people going. One of the reasons why his support base is so much in favor of him, it seems like he knew where to tap, what sector. He knew what sector he had to tap into. Is he going by some kind of playbook, or what is his strategy? How do you see that? How do you see the way he has acted here?
I'm not sure if it's a playbook or a strategy, but certainly he's tapped into something profound in the base of his supporters. Mr. Trump likes to portray himself as a victim, as a man who is aggrieved perpetually that is what he's doing in the wake of the raid on Mar-a-Lago. He is the victim. Many in his base, believe it or not, they consider themselves to be victimized. They consider themselves to be victims of an out-of-touch political elite, just like Mr. Trump oftentimes attacks this very same elite. And so he is on the same page with his base, and at the same time, many in his base are very happy that he tilted the courts to the right. Some in his base are very happy that he cut taxes for the wealthy, even though most of the 75 million who voted for him are certainly not wealthy. So this is a very contradictory coalition, but it's a dangerous coalition at the same time.
One of the political science professors at the University of California made an interesting statement, Robert Petillo. Over the past 6 years, all the warning signs for civil war, as she said, have emerged in the U.S., and they've emerged at a surprisingly fast rate. This sounds like when Trump came into office, of course, minus the almost 2 years that Biden has now been into office. Are we really looking at a point in U.S. history that's unprecedented, where it's going to require masses that can bring the temperature down? Or are we squarely need to look at Trump for him to rally his support base? Or is this out of his hands at this point?
I think it's out of his hands at this point. As I said, he's more so a mascot, a unifying figure in the movement. But I'll give you an example. When the vaccine rollout took place last year, President Trump was highly in favor of the vaccine. He motivated his people to take the vaccine. He wanted to take credit for the vaccine rollout. His base rejected that because they are anti-government, anti-deep state, anti-one-world government controlling them, and Trump was forced to bend to their will on those issues. And so what we've seen is Trump is a businessman. He's a real estate mogul. He's a television star. He knows how to read a poll, read a room, and know where his base of support is, and then to modify his messaging to work within that coverture. Him and Boris Johnson are very similar in that they portray this almost working man image, man of the people, when in reality they work directly for the elites and for the millionaire and billionaire class. So with Trump, it's not simply enough to stop him from running. We have to find ways to solve the issues of these aggrieved groups who believe that America is falling away from them. They call themselves the grand old party for a reason. They want to go back to the good old days when minorities were kept as second class citizens, where women had very little to no rights, where the economy was set up for their ethnic group and their social group to be at the top of the American system. We have to find ways to talk to them, to incorporate them back into American society in such a way that we all can prosper going forward and not allow them to simply continue to grow into this counterinsurgency group in the background. Because long after Trump is gone, you know, he's in his mid to late 70s and not particularly physically fit. Long after he's gone from the political scene or from this earth, these groups will still be there, and they will still be a force in American politics that have to be dealt with.
All right, very well. We're going to end it there since we're out of time. But thank you very much for that, Robert Petillo, political strategist from Washington, D.C. Gerald Horn, a pleasure. Thank you for your input. Professor of History at the University of Houston. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batavoy and the team, this is goodbye. Until next time.